This is Arthur Gase in Nuremberg, Germany. Never in the history of mankind have supposedly civilized human beings enslaved their fellow men and dealt with them so brutally as have these Nazis. That has been the brunt of the evidence presented all day today by American Associate Prosecutor Thomas Dobb as he showed from German documents how 4,795,000 foreign civilians and 1,873,000 prisoners of war became work slaves. From Alfred Rosenberg's own files, Dodd quoted, "We now experience the grotesque picture of having to recruit millions of laborers from the occupied eastern territories after prisoners of war have died of hunger like flies in order to fill the gaps that have been formed within Germany." Now the food question no longer existed. In the prevailing limitless abuse of Slavic humanity, recruiting methods were used which probably had their origin only in the blackest periods of the slave trade, unquote. I can see Simon Legree Fritz Sauckel sitting down there now. He has had beads of sweat on that shiny bald pate of his most of today. Barbet Spare, who has appeared so innocent-like at this trial, moved around slightly flushed and uneasily today, for as Minister of Armaments and Ammunition, he ordered that prisoners of war were to be employed in armament production, to be taken from camps for that purpose. One of Sauckel's reports actually stated that out of the 5 million foreign workers who arrived in the Reich, not even 200,000 of them came voluntarily. Out of Polish Minister Frank's files, there was this report, quote, "At the beginning, they received half a loaf of bread as daily ration, and later one loaf for 7 persons daily, black coffee at breakfast and supper and soup at dinner time. They never had a day off. They had to work even on Sundays. Terrible frosts were prevalent there, and the lads got no warm clothes. They worked in the clothes they had brought with them," unquote. Sauckel's office issued special regulations for these prisons. To violate them meant transfer to a concentration camp, or if there was some special offense, it meant hanging. The result of all this was decimation of a flower of manhood in all surrounding countries. The most startling revelation came from Dr. Jager of the Krupp Armament Works in Essen, where workers were given 1,000 calories of food a day less than the minimum prescribed for Germans, and where 600 Jewish women were brought from Buchenwald walking in their bare feet. The sole clothing of each consisted of a sack with holes for their arms and head. Their hair was shorn. Jager reported to his superior that the guards lived and slept outside their barracks, as no one could enter them without being attacked by 10, 20, and up to 50 fleas. Doctors refused to enter the camp. After listening to this day of testimony, Uncle Tom's Cabin appears like a fairy tale. However, this story has just begun, and when the evidence on the prosecution of the Jews is presented tomorrow, and the French and Russians tell their story later, every one of these criminals will be tarred black. This is Arthur Gase in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York. Today, an Irishman, a man named Robert F. Walsh, one of the American associate prosecutors, has been presenting to this court the story of the persecution of the Jews, or as he put it, the endeavor of the Nazis to obliterate the Jewish race. We had been listening all morning to a recital of concentration camp murders. The effort of Prosecutor Dodd was to tell the story of the purpose of the camp, not so much to depict their atrocities, although presented in evidence was a piece of tattooed human skin out of Buchenwald prepared by one Andreas Pfaffenberger, a butcher by trade, before he was employed at Buchenwald. Also presented was a shrunken human head taken from a Polish prisoner who had been beheaded for associating with a German woman. The death books from the camp at Mauthausen were put in evidence, showing 35,318 recorded deaths from the camp in a period of 5 years. Actually, an investigation of the record showed, for example, that in a period of 12 hours in one day, 203 persons died, all listed with the same ailment, heart trouble, and all dying in alphabetical order. The natural conclusion is that these people were executed. From Flossenburg, we had the story that in 1944, a number of prisoners were hanged on Christmas Day, and that the inmates had to attend the hanging, but next to the gallows was a decorated Christmas tree. With that type of evidence, you can imagine that the atmosphere here has been very heavy. On several occasions, there was a deadly stillness among the prisoners. Shock,
seems most seriously affected. His face is generally slightly flushed, but as I see him down there now, there's a gray hue over that redness. However, he has had his earphones on and seems to be following the whole proceeding. Seisinkwart, the Austrian, also seems much affected. Now that the persecution of the Jews is being presented, we have been watching Streicher, the Jew-baiter. But that yokel, who published all that damaging bunk in his weekly, the Stürmer, probably thinks he's the victim of a Jewish plot. He probably doesn't even recognize that Prosecutor Walsh is an Irishman. Placed in evidence were such Stürmer announcements as the Jewish use of human blood in rituals, that the Bible is a criminal romance, etc., etc. As Walsh put it, it's difficult to believe that falsehoods such as these could fall on fertile soil, but with a lying press and complete control of the literature of the country, such doctrine could be fed the German people, and many apparently believed. There is a note of retribution in the report from Dachau. The 40 Nazis tried at that concentration camp were all convicted, 36 to hang, 3 to 10 years, and 1 sentenced for life. This is Arthur Gates speaking in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg, Germany. After this morning's session of these trials, Goering was heard to say to one of the security staff, and I quote, "We are having an extremely difficult week." It is the type of evidence that we have heard for the past 2 days which brings to light all the brutality of the German program against the Jews, Poles, and others that is bound to bore into these men, hard and callous as they may appear. One of the medical men told me this noon that von Rippentrop, Dönitz, Franz, and Seisinkwart definitely are showing the effects of this type of testimony. Take this fellow Kaltenbrunner, who was hospitalized on November 18th with a cranial hemorrhage and who has been in court only this week. Outwardly, he appears to be a brute type. His face is scarred with sore glasses, probably from his student days. He has a big frame and is almost 6 feet 4 inches tall. He has a hard, calloused look. Yet he breaks down and cries, and he'll even talk about his Berlin mistress with tears in his eyes. He's the type of fellow that will try every turn of law which he knows to keep from the gallows, but once the situation is hopeless, will probably attempt suicide. Kaltenbrunner's attorney tried a move this morning to force the prosecution to bring German witnesses into court for cross-examination rather than merely permit their affidavits to be read. His thought was that cross-examination might break down an affidavit of the type we heard yesterday when that of the butcher Pfaffenberger was read in corroboration of the exhibit of tattooed human skin which was shown in the courtroom. The tribunal ruled that affidavits are to be admitted, but if their signers are available and the defense petitioned, they may be brought into court. This noon we heard the affidavit of a Dr. Wilhelm Hippel, who was a major of the hated SS. Hippel gave us figures that approximately 4 million Jews were killed in the various extermination camps, while an additional 2 million met death in other ways, the major part of which were shot by operational squads of the security police during the campaign against Russia. You and I find that difficult to believe, but last Sunday I was at St. Ottilien, which is the DP hospital for displaced Jews. Dr. Zelman Greenberg, in charge there, is a Lithuanian Jew who survived Dachau. When the Germans marched into Lithuania in 1941, they ordered all Jews into a ghetto. There were 35,000 of them. On October 28, 1941, the SS leader Rauke ordered 10,800 of those Jews to be taken out and shot. In the next 2 years, 80% of the remaining people were literally worked to death. When the Russians began threatening, the physically able, about 2,000 of those left, were brought first to Tegendorf near Danzig and then to Dachau. Miraculously, about 500 of those people made their escape just before the close of the war. Today, of the Jewish population of 35,000 that lived in Kaunas, Lithuania, in 1941, about 500 people survived. When you talk with one of these people and hear his story, the horror of this whole dastardly Nazi program strikes home. This is Arthur Gates speaking from Nuremberg. I return you now to the Neutral Newsroom in New York.
This is Applegate in Nuremberg, Germany. In the courtroom today, the prosecution changed a concept some of us might have gotten, that this trial concerns only the 21 men sitting down there. Every one of them is deeply involved in this conspiracy against other peoples of the world. But there are many more Germans also involved who are not sitting down there on those benches. Colonel Robert G. Story, one of the American associate prosecutors, today began to bring evidence against what the Germans called the Hoheitsträger, or participators in sovereignty, the 15 Nazi party leaders of the whole Reich, then the leaders of the 41 Gaus or provinces, the leaders of the hundreds of countries or counties, thousands of communities, and tens of thousands of blocks. Actually, this trial today involved about 600,000 Nazis in the conspiracy, and the court is being asked to decide whether they also are guilty not only of conspiracy, but of crimes against humanity and the other charges brought. It is difficult to grasp the implications of all this. Last week, when the military commission handed down the decision at Dachau, it stated that any German involved in the administration of the concentration camp participated in the guilt of those 40 who were being sentenced. That means thousands of others. Personally, I think that is just. But what I ask myself is, who is going to try all these people? It is all right to accuse them, but how are we going to bring them to justice with practically every American, including some involved in this prosecution, straining at the leash to get home, some of them literally running out on their jobs? If you ask me if we are going to see justice done by all these Germans, I'm prepared to say no, for the majority of the people involved are not concerned enough to see this job through until we have established the guilt or innocence of all the Germans who were involved in producing the tremendous misery that has resulted in Europe. There will have to be a change of heart in many circles unless our attempt to bring Germans to justice is not ultimately turned into a farce. Today, the prima donna of the crowd down there began to hear his name mentioned, Baldur von Schirach, once the leader of the Hitler Jugend, and finally the Gauleiter in Austria, was repeatedly included in the leadership of the party responsible for our troubles. Young and good-looking as the fellow is, and he's only about 34, he develops one of the greatest perversions of young people ever witnessed, and he turned the youngsters of the Reich into a fanatical band of tyrants. As they grew up under the leadership of men like Schirach, they became the fervent followers of the Führer, who literally went through hell for him. Today, a startling order from Albert Hofmann, important member of the Nazi leadership corps, was introduced here, and I quote from it. Fighter bomber pilots who are shot down are not to be protected against the fury of the people. I expect from all police officers that they will refuse to lend their protection to these gangster types. Authorities acting in contradiction to the popular sentiment will have to account to me. End of quote. That throws interesting light on a subject important to Americans and shows that Nazi leaders actually fomented and supported violence. This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg. I return you to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
This is Arthur Gates in Nuremberg, Germany. American Associate Prosecutor Colonel Robert G. Story of Dallas, Texas, spent most of this afternoon demonstrating to the military tribunal that the government of Germany was completely dominated by the Nazi Party. He pointed out that this party, of whom all the defendants sitting down there in the courtroom were leading members, actually formed a cabinet, ministries, and councils so that they could give a semblance of legality to all their actions. The point Story made was that the Reich's government was actually, or had actually, become the criminal instrument of the party. Among the interesting evidence produced was the fact that in 1937, the ban of party membership was lifted, and all members of the cabinet not in the party were given the golden badge of membership. At that time, only one prominent public official, Baron von Eltz, the minister of the post, had courage enough to decline membership. There is much whining now among these Germans that they could not escape party membership. In 1937, one man had courage and survived. Too many of the others probably were too willing to get into the select class. The prosecution today labeled Alfred Rosenberg the chief thief of the Nazi system. He was placed in charge of lifting valuable books, documents, and art objects all over Europe. Museums, private homes, Masonic lodges, Rotary clubs were the sources of loot, so much so that it has taken 39 volumes to incompletely catalog all the art objects that have now been recovered. From France alone, some 26,984 railroad cars were lifted in a three-year period. A report shows practically 70,000 Jewish homes confiscated with that many sets of furnishings. An incomplete catalog shows over 10,000 paintings taken, including masterpieces by Rembrandt, Raphael, Bruegel, Rubens, Dürer, Reynolds, Romney, and others. There were practically 2,500 pieces of museum furniture, much of it from the collections of Louis XIV and XVI. There were practically 600 carpets and tapestries, thousands of antiques, oriental pieces, and handmade art objects. There was indication that Goering, Goebbels, and others quarreled among themselves as to who would obtain what, and that Goering actually had special agents out who brought into him hundreds of valuable pieces with which to decorate his apartments, castle, and offices. Never has there been such high-handed stealing. Not the Metropolitan Museum, the French Louvre, British Museum, or the Moscow Hermitage, if their collections were all combined, could compare in value with the loot these Nazis took. Today, these fellows down there were made to look like gangsters and thieves. They were practically robbed of their respectability, but late this afternoon, Hess still had the gumption to smile when he was being played up as the man through whose hands all legislation enacted in the Reich had to pass. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg, Germany. There is increasing evidence of the Christmas spirit in this city, which once was the center of the gingerbread and metal toy industry of Europe, and which was famous for its Christmas market and popular festivals. It is not easy to catch the Christmas spirit among these ruins, for of the 121,000 living quarters which Nuremberg had in 1940, 68,000, or more than 50%, were destroyed. Of the literally hundreds of large and small toy manufacturing centers, employing some 18,000 people, only 24 are still in operation, and they work only part-time with about one-tenth of their former employees. The world's largest gingerbread factories of Heberlein and Metzger, which once employed up to 1,500 people in the Christmas season, today have no more than 130 employees. However, in the midst of all this, it is a wonder that they are operating at all. With a struggle for existence so severe, you wonder that people would think of Christmas and would make every effort to find tree decorations and presents. The spirit goes on. Yet some of the market squares are stacked with trees selling from 1 to 5 marks, not much more than in normal times. There are some wooden tree decorations available, and you can see people carrying home their trees and their handbags. We've had sunshine here the last 2 mornings, and men and women were out early trying to get into the few operating shops for what there is still left to buy. We watched more than 400 people line up before a gingerbread shop to stand for an hour or more for the little sack of these cakes they can buy with one of their bread ration coupons. The stationery stores and the tailors and dressmakers will probably supply most of the presents that are given, for there is little for sale. People are having clothes made over. There are long lists of exchanges offered in the want ad announcements with parents willing to exchange clothing for toys. I visited the famous toy manufacturing factory of Fleischmann Brothers this morning. About 50 people were employed there. They were still turning out the steam engines and electric trains for which they were known even in the United States. Those were the better trade toys that would sell for 400 to 500% their cost in America. They were made by unexcelled workmen. Today, the American Third Army is taking the full output. Motor-driven boats, electric trains, and steam engines. Not one of those toys will be available on the German market. Americans have had an opportunity to buy them in the PXs. Fleischmann Company made machine gun clips during the war, but stored its machines and could convert immediately. The raw materials were available. All the tin plate must now come from the French and British zones, and until now no arrangements have been made. The famous Nuremberg gingerbread, which once was displayed in the leading department stores in New York City at Christmas time, is no more. Sugar, nuts, and egg whites are lacking. We had a taste of the pre-war quality, for a few cookies are being made as special Christmas gifts, but the spiced cakes now being put out are only a shadow of what once was. Yet people will stand in line for hours for them. At the famous Haberlein Metzger factory, 60% destroyed by bombs, we watch the women work the machines which knead the dough, which cut the cakes, which are then fed into the long electric stoves, only one of which is operating. It is extremely difficult to catch the Christmas spirit here, but that toys are still being made and cakes being baked among these ruins is evidence that somehow the symbolism of this festival has not died and that people are trying to keep it alive. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg, Germany. Hess, Bormann, von Neurath, Rippentrop, Stauffel, Seyss-Inquart, and Kaltenbrunner were faced with most serious charges today as Associate Prosecutor Major Warren Farr laid bare the different ways in which the SS was an unlawful political organization that should be declared criminal. There was only one happy man on the bench down below me as Farr ably piled up his evidence to show how the defendants were the leaders of this great gang of murderers. That was Hans Frank, uncrowned King of Poland, who was indicted in the original document as an SS general, which was a mistake. Frank, who already is burdened with so many serious charges out of his ruthless administration of the Polish government general, seemed visibly relieved, and he and Frick turned to each other with an attitude of gratification, for after Farr's presentation during the last 2 days, there was little doubt left of the murderous purposes of the SS. It operated the concentration camp. It was the spearhead in the persecution of the Jews. Millions of murderers can be traced to its doors, and the tribunal could well rule that all of its members were part of the conspiracy and were to be brought before the court. When the tribunal recessed just a half hour ago for the Christmas holidays, Colonel Robert Story was presenting another important case against the SD, or the German Security Organization, and the Gestapo, or the state criminal police, whose horror record is almost inconceivable, what with gas chambers and death vans. In reviewing the results of the first month of these trials, I want to say that generally much more was accomplished than any of us expected. There's been an extensive amount of hard work done. Originally, the United States was going to prosecute the criminals it apprehended alone. Then it was decided to split up the case among the four great powers so that there had to be an exchange of evidence with the other nations taking over parts of the prosecution, somewhat scrambling some of the case. Whoever knows anything about joint operations of countries realizes that such action presents its difficulties, what with languages, tempers, and other problems involved. The American presentation will not be finished until after the recess. Much credit and praise is due the men who have been preparing the evidence. And the few so-called glaring weaknesses in the presentation of our case came to the surface when, for unknown reasons, attorneys have been allowed to present the evidence before the tribunal, evidence which they had not prepared themselves. When the tribunal reconvenes again on Wednesday, January 2nd, there will be a return to the American and then to the French and Russian presentations, after which the defense will have its day, which should be an extremely interesting one. This is Arthur Gaeth in Nuremberg. I return you now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.